You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders, for coders, about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beej, the optimistic newbie developer. Welcome to another episode of Complete Developer Podcast. This week, we're talking about how to become a freelance web developer. First, we'll talk about the benefits and pitfalls of freelance development and the type of person that will succeed in the market. Next, we're going to talk about how to find your niche. And finally, we'll get down to business by discussing what it takes to start your own freelancing business. But before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
Well, it's kind of odd that this is coming up because I'm actually in the process of closing down my business accounts for Gantt Software Systems. And the reason is I've got a full-time job. Agulous, you know, is going along, but it's a different company. And, you know, the podcast is not a company yet. And so the only thing for the last few months that Gantt Software Systems has actually done is pay for QuickBooks and pay for lots of other things. And I'm like, why am I keeping this thing open? Like it's a lot of complexity that I can close off and a lot of cost that I can get rid of, because for right now I'm going back into the full-time thing and then I'm doing this and I'm doing Code Newbies and then I've got the stuff on Agulous, but none of those things are within the scope of that business. So I'm in the process of going through and changing the card that's attached to every service that company has.
Yeah.
And switching that stuff over and trying to clean things up. So that's what I'm doing right now. So I'm on the end of this process. And I did freelancing for 3 years and some change. Yeah, give or take. I can't remember exactly when I actually filed the paperwork. I think it's been like 3.5 years. Anyway, and I did it for a pretty good while. You know, that was my job. You know, I learned a lot as I did it. You know, one thing I learned was that I really need to actually take vacations.
Yes.
And have time off. Like I'm struggling at work right now. I have like 2 weeks of paid time off, and I think I have to use them before the end of the year, but I'm not sure. And I'm like, can I get an extension on that? I don't even know what I want to, like, I have no idea of what I want to do with that time. Like what, I'm going to come home and play World of Warcraft or something? I mean, like I legitimately don't, cause I've been out of that habit for a while. And so I think that's something I've learned. But anyway, the long and the short of it is that I'm switching back to full-time employment because of other things I have going on. Mm-hmm. It's not that I'm giving up on the consulting thing. It's just that, hey, that's not where the bread's getting buttered right now and might not be for a pretty good while.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that for your situation,
yeah,
things moved in a different direction.
Yeah, and I mean, it could move back. Like I could get cut loose tomorrow. And, you know, the business license is actually still valid, so it doesn't, you know, it wouldn't actually affect anything. I just would have to undo all the work I've done this last week, moving things and just move them back.
Yeah.
But for, you know, stuff that I'm kind of using for businessy like stuff, you know, they have business tasks in there. I want to be able to use it on my personal stuff, and I want to not be paying 2 Comcast bills. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a big part of it, too. But, you know, I'm getting all that kind of wound down for now, and I'll spin it back up if I need it.
Yeah. And you're setting it up to where you can do that.
Yeah, because I'm not burning through cash like crazy. So how about you?
Well, I can definitely tell you I'm getting comfortable with my coworkers and, well, really enjoying my job. We had a sprint retrospective this afternoon. And, you know, at the beginning of the meeting, we have to rate our feelings of safety and security on a scale of 1 to 5. I put 3.14159, and the scrum master, she's going through and like marking them on the board, you know, on the where, yeah, so we can see like most people are 4 or 5 or something. And she reads it and she's like, all right, who put pi? And so I said,
you didn't put 1.618.
So I was like, well, somebody's feeling very irrational, and kind of giggled. And everybody looked at me and were like, we think he did it.
Yeah. You're going to be the guy rocking the math jokes.
Yes.
Yeah. Somebody said, if you're not part of the solution, I said, then you're part of the precipitant. So did you just bust a chemistry joke?
So
that's good. I mean, it means you're comfortable. I mean, that's a pretty huge thing, is to be the point where you can actually joke around in meetings.
Yeah. And it was good because it was lighthearted and a sprint retrospective. For those of you guys that haven't been to one or haven't studied what Scrum is, it involves getting together with the entire team and you kind of go through
a complaining session, if you will.
Yeah. Well, the way we have it set up is things that we need to start doing, things that we need to stop doing, and things we need to keep doing. Management is not supposed to be there. It's an environment where you write down, the way we do it is we put them on sticky notes, write them down, and then we throw them all into a pile. The Scrum Master grabs them and puts them on the board, and then she reads through them and we discuss them. Typically, what happens is the more pertinent topics get listed three or four times.
Yeah.
Because several people are thinking the same thing, and it spurs that discussion. And so it can get heated at times. And so starting off, in my opinion, starting off with kind of a lighthearted, kind of joking thing, it's kind of nice. Of course, in the stop doing things, I also wrote, people need to stop putting goofy answers on these cards. Because everybody read there, she read that and everybody looked at me again. And I'm like, all right, seriously, guys, if it's bothering you, let me know. I was like, I wrote that because I thought about it after I did it. I'm like, I did that to be lighthearted and, kind of set a mood of amicability.
It's hard to balance that and know exactly where.
And everybody kind of was like, no, that was kind of funny. That's cool. We like starting off with a little bit of a joke. So
yeah, before everything gets bad.
Yeah.
No. So, I guess it's going well for you over there. I mean that.
Yeah, it really is. I went to lunch with, one of our code newbie members.
Folks. Yeah.
She works with me now. And we've kind of developed a group. We're not even on the same project, but there's about four or five of us that we get lunch together once or twice a week. And we just sort of, I'm developing friends, and was actually thinking when I move, probably a couple of weeks after I move, I'm going to want to have some friends over just to sort of celebrate the new place and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was thinking today, I'm like, these are the people I'd want to invite over. I'm like, of course.
Yeah. You, that's and your good wife, that you built the camaraderie too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's massively helpful.
Yeah. It really is.
Cause we do that at work, and the people that regularly go out to lunch, I mean, we'll butt heads, but it's mostly a lot more respectful because we have that social interaction.
Yeah. It humanizes people.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that I did mention in the meeting was... Well,
it humanizes most people.
Yeah. I'll say, this is one thing that I did mention in the meeting was we need to, as a team, maybe once a sprint or something, go out and get lunch together or some type of non-work social interaction.
Yeah.
Where we have a rule of not talking about the project because that...
And it's a work lunch if you're talking about the project.
Yeah. Of course, if we're talking about the project, maybe we can get work to pay for lunch, but not likely.
No. Yeah, you might as well hang that up.
Yeah.
Like, I tried to pull a gambit today because, the owners where I work, they have a meeting on Mondays.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lunch meeting. And one of the owners was like jokingly going, yeah, and I have to go to this thing. I'm like, you could send a proxy. And they look at me and I'm like, well, I'll take a free lunch. They're laughing at me. They're like, yeah, you would. So I guess with that, it's time to roll the music.
This week for IoTs, I have sort of a project. This is a project that's already been done. And, if you want to replicate this project, shoot me an email because I want to be involved. This is called the Mega Processor. And it was created by James Newman. He built it at Cambridge, and it is basically a microprocessor built large. very large.
So it's a macro processor.
Yes. Instead of microscopic transistors and silicon chips, it uses individual ones that would fit on a breadboard. Well, that do fit on a breadboard. He built it to show what actually is happening inside of modern computers and put LEDs on everything to see how they're working.
I like these kind of projects. I saw one a few years back that was built with hydraulics.
Neat.
Yeah, and they were like doing computing, you know, mm-hmm. like logic gates with hydraulics, which is somebody had some time.
Yeah. He can ramp it up to 8 megahertz. Of course, at that speed, the lights are pretty much just a solid.
Yeah.
But he, in the video that's in the link I'm going to post, he slows it down to around 1. You can see the lights flashing, and then he can stop it and do, you know, stepwise through a process. And then he shows how he can play games with it and stuff. And you can actually go and program it. As of June 22nd this year, it is built, and he's allowing people to come see it. And you can go on the site I'm going to post, download the programming, and write programs for it.
Nice.
Yeah. So if I'm ever over in Cambridge, I'm definitely going to check this out. It's a cool thing. So who's talking to us this week?
Well, we've got a comment from Carrie Green. Says, hey, Will and BJ, you guys have a pretty good sounding podcast. I'm impressed. And that's because of our audio engineer in the booth. Not really. That's because of Beej. Because we don't have an audio engineer in the booth right now.
Yeah, he's down in Atlanta working very hard.
Yeah.
But thanks, Carrie. We have some Complete Developer swag just for you. And guys, if you'd like some CDP swag, leave us a review in iTunes or comment on the website. We also post all our shows to Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and LinkedIn. So this episode is a culmination of several previous episodes, and a few ones that haven't been recorded yet, though they may be published before this one comes out. It kind of puts the pieces together in a way to help you to become a self-sufficient freelance developer. So we're going to start off talking about why you would want to be a freelance developer. And I've broken this down into benefits and pitfalls. And I'm sure Will, having done it for quite a few years, me having done it for a few months, we can throw in a few more as we go through this list. So the first, and what I think we should do,
is probably the most controversial one is the first.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say what we should do is they match. So we'll talk about the benefit and then the pitfall.
All right. Works for me.
So the first is
work-life balance.
Yes. Better work-life balance.
Yeah. And I think that's probably one that's, it's very hard for me to say that that is, has been a thing for me. And part of that was because I did the contracting and I was also developing a business.
Yes.
At the same time, like I was trying to build a side business and, you know, we were launching the podcast and we were doing, you know, there's a bunch of stuff going on, a lot of moving parts. And it's very, I think this would be better rephrased as you have more control over your work-life balance.
Or more opportunity
to fix it.
Yes. The major pitfall for it is that when you're not working, you're looking for more work.
Yes. When you are working, you're looking for more work if you don't want a giant gap.
Yeah.
And you're trying to figure out how to schedule things and you have overlaps and it gets pretty hairy pretty quickly. And if you're not looking for work, you're using a recruiter, mm-hmm. which means you get a lower pay rate while you're working.
Yes.
They take a cut off the top. So you have to play that game too.
Which, that's not a bad thing. We had the episode with Lena about recruiters, and we're going to do one in the future talking about working with recruiters from the developer angle.
Yeah.
And, you know, some things that, while she talked about the recruiter angle and what developers don't know or may not fully understand about recruiting from that angle, we'll talk about it from the being a developer going that direction.
Yeah. It's just a thing of you have to be aware that there is a trade-off
for
this flexibility.
Mm-hmm. And part of that comes with the next benefit, which is being your own boss.
Well, and this is another one that also can be a little bit interesting because, yes, you're your own boss in the sense that you can find the work that you want to find and you can mm-hmm. pick which path you want to go on a lot more easily than if you're working for somebody else because they pick. But the other side of it is you do have the burdens of being a boss. So you are accountable to a client. You also have to have insurance mm-hmm. and things like that your boss typically covers in a full-time job. You have more expenses in regards to Social Security. You know, you got bookkeeping. You got a lot of other things that tend to be kind of in the background that developers don't think about. So you are your own boss, and that comes with the blessings and the curses thereof.
And, you know, these sort of flow, but as your own boss, having the ability to balance work and life, you're able to choose your own hours.
Yeah. And I would argue this depends on client selection, because there's a lot of clients who have got the mindset that if you're a contractor, you actually can't come and go as you please, which, by the way, that means that they should be paying they should be matching the employer taxes, Social Security, and all that kind of stuff, because mm-hmm. they're actually treating you as an employee
yes.
at that point. And they're, you know, when you'll be in the office from this time to this time and you have no control, and you'll see that in a lot of contract jobs and that. So this doesn't really hold true. However, if you are developing stuff for people and they aren't forcing you to be in an office, then you do pick. Now, the downside of this is you do choose your own hours.
And it's easy to develop poor habits.
Yes. And I did a fair bit of this. And I can really speak to it after 3.5 years. After a while, you get to the point where you're, especially when things are tight, it's very easy to put off going to the gym. It's very easy to go, okay, I'm not going to eat because I've got to get this thing done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also quite easy to end up in a situation where you are in a stressful environment and you're putting up with it for extended periods of time. So now things like sleep deprivation come in. Things like, you know, eating really bad food, sitting, you know, repetitive motion injury. You know, I had some of that a couple of years ago. In fact, I just saw my Facebook post from when I was working at this awful company here locally
mm-hmm.
From 2 years ago. And I was putting in like 80-hour weeks, like legitimately, like 80 billable. And I have a brace somewhere because I started developing carpal tunnel type symptoms. Like my hands were just hurting so bad. And it was because I was spending too much time working and I was not in a position I felt where I could argue that, hey, I need a desk that's actually not painful, because it was like a sharp counter edge
mm-hmm.
and you're putting your wrists on that when you're typing because you're crammed together with a bunch of other people and you don't have space. And that was the singularly worst gig I probably have ever had, just in terms of just death march and hours and just the way people acted. And they've since lied about me. So they were everything I expected.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to know who that is, you can call me. I'm not going to put it on the podcast, but I'll happily tell you.
Mm-hmm. The next benefit is you get the opportunity to work on more interesting projects.
Yeah. If you've got an abundance, you can pick things that are more interesting versus, yeah, we need you to fix this double entry, you know, bookkeeping system. You know, that can be kind of boring unless accounting's your thing, and then maybe not.
Yeah.
But you do get a broader range of projects. It's not just that, you know, any one project is interesting, but you might jump around. Like the stuff I was doing, I was working with educational software when I was, when I started contracting. Initially, I was contracting, but I was an employee. I was just doing contract gigs through a recruiter, and then I kind of did my own thing. And so like I started out, and the first one was educational related software. And the second one was teacher evaluation related software. So it was still education. And then let's see, after that was agriculture. And then it was medical, and then back to agriculture, and then printing, which is what I'm doing now. Well, printing and a lot of other things. I know my boss is probably listening to this too. But, you know, I've jumped around a lot, and so I've got a pretty wide range of experiences. However, one other thing that does happen is it's very easy to get in a situation where you're where money gets a little bit tight. Like, for instance, we were moving, and I got downsized after we'd already started the process of, like, buying a house and selling a house. I got, you know, I got cut from a contract, or got cut down to, like, 8 hours a week or something stupid that was like, yeah, I'm not sticking around for this. You crazy?
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't pay my bills if I was a college student for this. And that happened in the middle of it. And I had to take a position, and it was an hour drive from the house. And it was that horrible, horrible job. And it's like, we're trying to get a new house and we've got all these expenses and I've got to stay here. And it's very easy to get in that situation, even if you've saved, because, you know, I thought I was in something steady. The project had, you know, probably another 6 to 8 months to go. There didn't look like I was going to get cut, and it was just a funding, you know, venture capital thing. And they just, you know, that's what happened.
That's one of the risks. And that's one of the pitfalls is sometimes you have to take work just to pay the bills.
Yeah. And, you know, because you're there as a mercenary, they're going to give you the worst stuff because they care about turnover of their employees. Contractors are disposable.
Yeah.
Like in the movie Braveheart, do you remember that one battle where they're like, oh, send in the Irish, and, you know, they're shooting arrows, you know, onto the battlefield right now. Mm. But hey, send in the Irish because the dead don't cost anything. You're Irish in that situation. Like, that's not.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, true. And by the way, the luck of the Irish has always been a phrase that has made me kind of cock my head to the side because I'm like, did you ever open a history book? Like, they're lucky because they're still here. Like, they've had some legitimately bad luck. Like, yeah.
Finally, contractors do tend to get paid more than full-time employees.
If you're doing anything remotely right. That said, your net can be lower at a much higher rate of pay. Like, for instance, you know, if you take my salary that I was getting before I started contracting, you divide that by 2,000, you get a rough hourly.
Mm-hmm.
And then my salary would have been, or my hourly rate times 2,000 once I started contracting, was quite a bit higher. It was like 25K higher.
Yeah.
My take home was lower. And part of that was because I was not charging enough. You know, and that legitimately added stress because I was packing on hours to do that.
Yeah.
But you also have the opportunity to pack on hours if you can. And sometimes that can help you out of a financial crunch because you can go, hey, I need money for whatever. Can I do some more hours? And they have a deadline and you're productive and you can do it.
No. Also, as a contractor, you're not likely to have benefits.
Yeah, you do not have benefits, more than likely. Well, you're an employee of where you're working.
Yeah, I'm an employee.
You're an employee of the recruiting company.
Recruiting company, yeah.
Yeah, that's different. Yeah, like we're like full on freelance, like.
Oh, yeah. Full on freelance now.
Yeah. You have nothing. There's no safety net. There's the ACA, you know, and all the stupidity that's around that thing that's so destructive to anybody's ability to actually launch a business. I was lucky that, you know, my wife has health insurance. That, you know, we've got that set up that way because I wouldn't have been able to do it. Or I would have had to charge like $20 an hour more, which probably would have been fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, and the other thing I did wrong, too, was and what actually forced me to raise my rate was I was working at that horrible death march job, doing 80 hours a week. And of course, you know, 40 to 45 of those hours are completely worthless. It was just somebody demanding that you sit in a chair because you can't focus that long. And then I started thinking, I'm like, okay, I'm here through another company. And then there's the recruiter that sent me to that company. And then there's my company. Oh, and this company does stuff for another company. So there's like three or four middlemen. And they're all happy. I'm not charging enough because they should be pretty upset, you know, at that arrangement because they're slicing a very thin slice of the pie versus obviously they're getting half, which is about actually turned out to be they're getting like three quarters. And so it's very easy to end up in that situation. Like you have to push to get the salary. You can't do the thing of just falling into a job and taking what they give you. You've got to really push for a higher salary or you won't make more. You'll make a lot less.
Mm, that's true. So, who is freelancing for?
Well, you've got to be very motivated.
Yes.
Because it can be extremely discouraging. I mean, you're going to actually go into situations where you're going to have to do sales.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're interviewing regularly. It'll hone the daylights out of your skills on that.
So you definitely need those interview skills, and you don't have a boss that's behind you pushing you for those deadlines.
Yeah.
That's something that until you don't have it.
Yeah, you realize that you miss that structure when it isn't there.
It's like being a medical student. You don't realize that you don't know how to study if you're highly intelligent.
Yeah.
Until you get to med school.
And then you realize that so is everybody else there, and those people are dropping like flies.
Yeah. And you either learn how to study.
Or you go home.
Yeah. Because there are people in med school who may not be the most intelligent people there, but they've learned how to study. And they're the ones that succeed.
Yeah.
They are. Then you also need to be skilled in your area.
Yeah. You can't be because I tried it when I was a junior dev. Mm-hmm. And I just bombed. It was extremely awful. I'll just put it that way. Like, it was mixing Taco Bell hot sauce with ramen noodles. Awful. Like, eating that for days at a time. That's all you eat because it's dirt cheap. Because, you know, you can get Taco Bell on Saturday night and you can grab enough sauce packets.
Yeah.
For the whole week with your ramen noodles. Because I'm going to spend like $6 on Saturday night for that one meal to get me through. Like, that's awful. You have to be skilled.
Yeah. Remember, you are the expert coming in. There's no one to ask advice from.
Yeah. Typically, there's not. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you'll get somebody that's got a particular subject area, but if you don't bring anything to the table, you're not going to be sitting there long.
Because they're not hiring you to
learn.
They're hiring you to solve problems. That's why they bring in.
And at your contracting rate, they probably have expensive problems to solve.
Yes. If we haven't scared you away yet.
Then we will.
Yeah. It's not an easy thing. A lot of people think, oh, I'll just go be a freelancer. And it's like, you need to know the realistic. There are benefits to it.
Yeah.
There's some really cool benefits to it. But there's also a lot of challenges.
And there's a lot of downside risk that you have to mitigate.
Yeah.
Up front.
And you really need to go into this knowing what you're getting into. So getting away from the why and the who and into the how to become one. You start off by finding your niche. I have a quote here from Ted Johnson that states, "Becoming known as the solution to a particular set of problems is crucial to your freelance career. So you need to be willing to differentiate and then lock it in."
I would agree with that. And I mean, that's kind of what I did, right? You pick an area and a language. So like I picked C#, ASP.NET, C#, SQL. It was pretty much what I did. And I kind of half specialized in cleaning up bad code.
The other thing is there needs to be a market for it. So it doesn't matter how much you enjoy or how good you are at Fortran.
Well, you know, you say that.
I'm just picking an old language. You know, but what like I'm Delphi? Saying is, well, yeah. Obviously, there's a market for that because you're working in it.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is there needs to be a large enough market.
Yeah, to support you, or you have to charge enough.
Yes.
To make it where you can retool, where you've got enough time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't do something that's both cheap and there's no jobs.
Yeah, no.
Like, I'm an HTML engineer. Congratulations, you're broke. Mm. Here's my favorite ramen noodle recipe. It's better with the fire sauce than with the mild.
You want to build your portfolio around your niche. Like, you may have other skills. Actually, you should have other skills. You want the focus of your portfolio to be on the skills that you are particularly selling.
Because otherwise, why are they on your site? You know, because I've done a lot of stuff in a lot of languages. Like, I could legitimately jump in and do Visual Basic 6 code right now. And I could get work doing it. And But I don't want to. And I don't want to show anything that I've written in that. If I could even find copies of it floating around, which is dubious at best.
Yeah.
But that's not the skill that I want to market. Like, market the thing you're trying to market. Because if you're marketing something else and thinking it's going to bring you traffic for something completely different, what are you doing?
And this is something that, well, for me, it was differentiating my blog from my portfolio. Because on my blog, I could go and post about all the different things that whatever I wanted to post about. But on the portfolio, I needed to keep it specific to the skills I was selling.
Well, you got to think about your blog is the top of your sales funnel. It's to get people onto your site from whatever. And then you refine that huge set of people into people that are paying you. And that's what the portfolio is for, is that is the great filter for those things. It, you may get pickups on the other stuff, but the really the top things are what's going to draw them in.
With this, you want to become an expert in your field. Just talking about blog posts, you want to read and write blogs in your area. Now, unlike your portfolio, you can diversify out your blog, but you do want to become an expert in the area. Yeah. This also could mean attending or speaking at conferences.
Yeah, we know several people that do that, and they've bumped their careers up. I mean, you and I are working on being able to do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's one of the next steps for both of us, is we're both in the process of putting together a few different courses that we can submit.
So, given that, let's talk a little bit about starting a business.
The first thing you want to do is discuss the business structure with your accountant.
Yes.
If you don't already have an accountant,
then you need to go ahead and get one.
Yeah.
I know you can start without, but especially for your first business, that's a real bad idea. There's a girl that you know better than I do, but I had a conversation with her once because she started a business doing some kind of artistic stuff and worked for all these companies and didn't realize that she had a higher tax obligation because she was self-employed until she got her tax bill and had zero spare money. And of course, she was whining about how the system's unfair and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you idiot, you didn't go to an accountant. It's just very easy to do. And mine was structured very much like a sole proprietorship. It was technically an LLC. But typically with a sole proprietorship, it is a single owner. You're responsible for assets, liabilities. You get sued, you can lose your house.
Yes.
Don't do this if there's any risk.
Yeah. I'll say sole proprietorships, in the litigious society that we have, it is just too risky when you can do a limited liability company or LLC.
Yeah. And you'll also run into similar things with partnerships, by the way.
Yeah. We'll get into that when we talk about partnerships. But an LLC has a reduced liability of something like a corporation, but the tax and operational benefits of a partnership or sole proprietorship.
Yeah. And these things vary a little bit from state to state, too. Yeah. So
a partnership, since we've already mentioned it, is a single business with multiple owners.
Yeah. It's two sole proprietors.
Pretty much.
Effectively. It's like, now you can get sued for something somebody else does. Did we talk about network effects? This is the sort of network effect you don't want to be in. No business partners.
So the general partnership is like what Will said, the sole proprietorship, but divided amongst the owners. Then there's the limited partnership, which is basically an LLC with multiple owners.
Yeah, kind of.
No. And then a joint venture, which is a general partnership, but with a time limit. And so.
And I did an LLC for my company, even though it was a sole proprietorship. And the big thing is, if something goes awry and people will sue for the most outlandish crap, I want to just be able to shut the business down and go, here's my extended middle finger. I'm going to walk away. I'm keeping my house and my car. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And to have some degree of shielding there because of, unless you do something really egregious and they actually pierce the corporate veil, which is what they call that, your stuff is safe.
And I mean,
and it should be. Think about your business license as paying the mob for protection. If you pay the mob for protection, unless you do something really, really bad, the mob will protect you. It doesn't make your business any more or any less of a business. It just is, hey, the mob is operating in this area. You better pay Don Corleone his money or your kneecaps might get broken. You have a nice business. I'd hate for something to happen to it.
Yeah. Finally, you have corporations, which are more complex, and they tend to be for larger or established companies.
And that's like joining the mob.
Yeah. Or the S corporation, which is like a corporation, except for you're taxed on a personal level.
Right. So the company can make $100,000 a year and you can say, I only make 30. And if it's within reason, that's the way that's figured. And the other money that stays in the corporation gets taxed at the lower rate. People think this is unfair, but here's what happens. When you're trying to build a business, one thing you have to have is capital. Mm-hmm. You've got to have money that you can when an opportunity strikes, because you think about it, okay, if I'm going to start working for somebody on a 6-month contract, Well, okay. Well, I've got to buy, I potentially have to buy computers. I potentially have to front travel expenses, and then I get paid back, but I have to have the money to be able to spend to get that money. So that's why corporate tax is at a lower rate, that and intensive lobbying. It protects it because otherwise a lot of these companies would never get off the ground. And this, by the way, was one of the big things that drove me towards full-time employment, was because I could not accumulate capital to grow my business, because every time I had extra money, it went to taxes. And I didn't have the S corp because, or the C corp either, because there's a lot of overhead. There's a lot of extra paperwork, and I didn't want to do the paperwork.
Yeah.
I will do it next time.
Once you've met with your accountant, kind of figured what is the best structure for you, you need to register your business with your local government. This could be the business name with the state, federal.
Yeah, you got to get a federal EIN for tax purposes. Also, bear in mind that your bank can help you file for an EIN. When you set up a business checking account, they can actually work through that. Like Bank of America did that for me. Like what I'm saying, there's other parties that can help that you don't have to pay. Like you don't have to go to a lawyer.
Yes, that's true.
You can get somebody that's already squeezing blood out of you and get them to do it. Like get a little bit of it back.
Next, you must get liability insurance.
Yeah. Errors and omissions and liability. Because if you screw up, and especially as a contractor, where they can throw you under the bus and, oh, maybe we can get a refund out of this guy, even though 90% of the work you did was good, 10% of it was crap and cost us X amount of money because we didn't plan, you're going to be the one going under that bus. You better have insurance.
And you need to write a business plan.
Well, yeah, let me add a caveat to that. You don't have to do a full-on business plan, because I didn't. It worked fine. But what you do have to do is you have to have some kind of vision and direction for what you want from the business and where you want to go. You do have to establish some degree of goals. In other words, in a year, what am I going to be doing? You know, what do I plan to do with this business? How do I, you know, what direction do I want to take it? And you also need to have some idea of how you're going to measure those achievements. Like you don't say, oh, well, I want to make a lot of money. Well, how much is a lot? You know, it's like, I want to make X thousand dollars. I want to not have a side job. You know, I want this to pay for my full-time income plus some. You do have to have all that kind of stuff laid out. So the next thing is, and this goes right along with the business plan, of course, you know, with the caveats that I mentioned, and that is set your rates.
This is something that...
Yeah, if you don't do this right, your business will tank.
Yes, and we have an entire episode just on setting your rates.
Yeah.
Start off by looking at the job market for your set of skills.
Yeah, and when you figure out the salary for that, bear in mind that the salary is not the full set of expenses that your employer is paying, right? They're matching Social Security costs. They are paying for employee training. They're paying for healthcare. They're paying for office space. They're, you know, paying for paid time off. Don't forget that one.
Oh, yeah, because you're not getting paid time off.
Yeah, like if you're earning, like let's say that your job is $100K a year for what you do. You should aim for an hourly rate that provides you with probably closer to $150 just to break even.
Look at the job market, then add expenses for using your own equipment, wear and tear, add expenses for your liabilities, your insurance.
Yeah, because my insurance was a car payment.
Time off.
Yep.
This is something that you may not be thinking about now.
After 3 years of no vacations, you will think about it because you've turned, you know, you've not gotten away and your ability to actually continue working disappears.
Because you may be thinking, oh, well, I can deal with a day or two here or there sick leave not getting pay.
Yeah.
That's survivable. Okay. Well, you know what? I went to a conference.
Yeah. You went to a conference for 3 days.
Yeah. For 3 days, I did not get paid.
Yeah. And I got the flu one time and I was out for several days. Also think about, you know, holiday pay and all that, like what happens to your cash flow then. You also have to make sure it's not just the cost of things like insurance, but you have to think about your cash flow. Because if you're paying for insurance, you know, once a year, guess what? Your cash flow just got deformed badly for that month. And you have to have enough money coming in that you can actually absorb that.
Yes.
Same thing with taxes, because taxes will burn you alive. You know, you'll get taxed on things you never thought about getting taxed on, or you'll find out that oh, hey, I have a home office and a server room. But because I did not do any paying work during these 2 months because there was a down period, I can't deduct those two rooms from my taxes.
Which is ridiculous.
It is absolutely obnoxious because you're trying to get work while this is going on and you can't. It's the system is you need to realize going in that the entire system is rigged against you and you need to price accordingly.
Basically, if you're being realistic, you're underpricing yourself.
If you're being realistic, double the rate.
The other thing too is you don't want to price yourself out of work.
Yeah. Like that's harder to do than people think it is.
Yeah.
One way that you can price yourself out of work is underprice, because then they think you're not qualified.
There is that.
One thing I noticed for a while there was I would raise my rate and there would be more work because it wasn't a linear relationship. You get high up enough on the curve, then it starts going back. Your workload starts going back down, but you don't care because you're making more money.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Like you want to be on the right side of that curve. You don't want to be on the left side because the left side guy is worked to death and getting paid crap.
Mm-hmm.
The guy on the right side isn't getting enough work, but he's getting paid through the nose, and so he can go deer hunting.
Yeah.
Whoop-de-doo. Yeah, and part of this, too, it has to do with understanding the value that you're providing, because it's very easy as a employee to go, my value is X dollars an hour to write code, whereas from a business owner's perspective, what it is, okay, this problem is costing me X dollars. If I can get it solved for X dollars minus 10% of X, I'm ahead and I've covered any potential risk and overhead.
Yes.
And that number can be quite large.
Mm-hmm. Next, you got to market your skills.
Yeah. And that's what I screwed up the first time is I did not.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because you can do it and you're out there doesn't mean you're going to get the jobs. You've got another quote, and this one's from Trey Fletcher. Get your name out there and establish a network of other freelancers and industry professionals, as well as rebuilding links with previous colleagues and employers.
And I've gotten a whole lot of work that way, just through my network. And honestly, I think if I had continued with the consulting, the stuff I've learned just working on the podcast and doing a lot of the other things, I would have been a whole lot better at that. Like if I ever go back and do it again, I'll be way better off this time because something I did not push because I thought, I'm just going to do sales when I'm doing sales. I didn't think of it in terms of putting people in the funnel and pipelining.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those kind of things. It was just, it was hit or miss. And then I control it once it comes in, but I'm not putting anything in.
So you got to start with an online presence. Make your website a showpiece. I mean, it's the top of the funnel. It is the first interaction you have with potential clients.
Yeah, or at least most of them.
Yeah, so you want to put your best work into it. I have talked to people who said, it's just my personal site. It's just, my site, so I didn't really put the effort into it because I was putting it into client work. It's like,
And
that's how you don't get clients.
Yeah, that's how you, when this client ends, you're sitting at home and you have lots of time to work on your company website. Like, this self-corrects.
Yeah, that's true.
You can run out of money while you're fixing the problem too.
It should self-correct, but
it doesn't with dumb people.
Yes.
Yeah. And everybody's dumb sometime.
And I've already mentioned this, but I'm saying it again. You got to have an online portfolio.
Yeah. And
you want the focus of your portfolio to be
what you're trying to sell.
Yes. The front page of my website is not going to be my portfolio. And that's the way you want to do that.
Yeah, but it still has to be attractive enough. But, you want to, you basically don't want to run them off and you don't want them to bounce.
And the next one is something that we've done an entire episode on, and that is use social media to your advantage.
Yeah, and we actually had a spike in traffic recently following this, including my boss actually liking that on LinkedIn, which threw me off because I didn't realize he was watching my LinkedIn. But you have to be conscientious about the social media advantage and getting your name out there and actually using the tools. Like,
I don't want to get into too much detail on social media because we do have an entire episode on it.
And that link will be in the show notes.
Yes.
So there you go.
But I do want to say that LinkedIn, does have a service for freelance developers, and it's to connect freelance developers with potential clients.
I did not know that.
Yes. That's how I got some of the clients I didn't get through you.
Okay. Well, next
remember when I told you about, like, I was working on a project and you're like, how'd you get a project? I'm like,
yeah,
that's it. It was through
LinkedIn. I didn't know that was the thing. Yeah. That's really cool. It's unfortunate that I'm finding out about this now.
Well, do you know about freelancing websites?
Yes. I used Rent-A-Coder. I was on rentacoder.com a long time ago, and that was terrible. Like, that was a race to the bottom on rates, because that was right as outsourcing became what all the cool kids were doing.
Okay.
And it's like, yeah, I can get $1.20 an hour for writing, you know, like, you know, web services and stuff.
That sounds like Fiverr.com or
whatever. Yeah, it was horrendously bad, and I never got anything through it. And there's a lot of these. There's Upwork, which used to be called something else, and then they rebranded. I've gone through these sites and hired people as well.
The thing that I noticed is that these really tend to be better for the more established developers.
Yeah,
it's less of a race to the bottom for that.
Yeah, because they have to put in years of work, and it's easier to get a stable income at a full time job. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of your low quality folks have either washed out, or they're inhabiting a cubicle somewhere and making work for other people, which, by the way, you can make a lot of money fixing the problems they create. No. But it's a more cold environment.
And you do spend a lot of time securing billable work.
Yeah. I'll throw another site out here that's not quite freelance, but it might be something that's interesting for senior developers. It's called Hack Hands, and people will pay you by the minute to help them with code. You also need social networking in meet space. I don't know of a better term, like non-virtual. IRL. Yeah.
In real life.
You know, the big blue room with a bright light up top that you walk out your front door and you're in it. You need to connect through friends and family. Like, people need to be aware of what you're doing. Like, don't launch a business and not tell anybody. Which I kind of did. It's very easy, especially the first time, because what you'll do is you go, okay, I'm launching this business, but I don't want everybody to know in case I fail, because that's embarrassing. Well, the problem is that you just insured your failure, because nobody knows you have a business. And it turns out that free advertising from people that already know you helps.
Well, that's something we did differently with the podcast, because we were proud of it. We created this creative thing, and we were telling everybody. I mean, my sister, who is a math teacher in Ohio, listens to the show. Hi, Lori.
And my wife does. You know, yeah, Kathleen listens to it for the same reason.
Hi, Kathleen.
Yeah.
Because they... Like, my sister enjoys the interaction, of course.
Well, it's just the thing of, if you're going to put yourself out there, put yourself out there.
Yeah,
like, exactly. Don't, you know, like, it's like jumping in a pool. You either are committed or you bash your head on the pavement.
Well,
you get friends and family and let them know what you're doing. You also may have peers. So, you've got other people that maybe need help. Because one thing that will happen to you as a freelancer is it's very easy to get into a situation where it's like, I made a terrible mistake. I went to an interview that a friend of mine hooked me up with, and it was on my birthday. And I had to wear a suit and tie on my birthday to go talk to these people. And I thought, okay, they need something that's probably, you know, it's in the tens of thousands of dollars, but, you know, I can build it for them, you know, fine. And I get there, and the system, like, within 5 minutes of the conversation starting, I've become acutely aware that this is probably like a $300,000 project. I could do it by myself, but then there's one point of failure. Like, if I get hit by a bus, where are they?
Yeah.
And so I called other people I knew. You know, there's a consulting company that I had done a bunch of work with, and they'd impressed me. And I'm like, well, actually, I didn't call them. I drove over there and walked into the VP's office and said, can I talk to you a minute? Because you have to do that, you know, and
yeah,
and
they remember that, by the way.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, they'll throw stuff your way, and vice versa. Like, you want those interactions. That's how everybody has enough. It's sort of like communism, except there's no scarcity and no death camps.
The other thing is local small businesses.
Yeah, because, well, you and I are going to do this at some point with a particular sector, is just go around and say, what's something that's causing you problems that you think can be fixed with code?
Yeah.
And that's how we're going to do market research, and we're going to build something. And you can do that in a lot of ways.
I want to pull a caveat here. You're known for them. I don't really do this often, but I want to pull a caveat here because it's something that I thought about and didn't put in the outline, but I think is important. And that is pro bono work. Pro bono work is fine. You do not do work for exposure. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. You do not do work for exposure.
Because you won't get exposure, you'll get exposed.
Yes. And then more
actually, you'll get exposure in the hypothermia sense.
Yes. And more people will come at you for work for exposure, and you will not get paid. Now, that said, that sounds harsh. It is okay to do pro bono work when you know it's pro bono work.
And you're not expecting anything from it.
Yes.
Like, don't get, you know, and this is something we probably need to talk about too, like just in the relationships type thing is, and it works in business too, is don't have covert contracts, because that's kind of what this is, right? It's, oh, I'm going to do this work for free for you, and it's multiple hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars worth of work, and I expect that I'm going to get something out of it. Well, if the other person isn't aware of that, you're not going to get it, and you're going to be disappointed because you put something in the situation that wasn't there.
Yes, exactly. So, going into it with full knowledge of this is pro bono work is one thing. You want to help out your local church.
Yeah.
Or, you know, local group that you're involved in.
Yeah, and there's also events. There's one that they used to have here, and they haven't had it in a while. But it was basically, it's like a hackathon, and you get together, and there's several charities there, and people break into teams, and they build stuff over a weekend. And, you know, that's totally fine. Just don't go into it thinking, this is going to get me exposure. It's like, no, go in there and do it because you want to help. And part of that's being realistic, and part of it is just like, why are you doing this? You know, because it's almost a skeezy feeling too. If you, you know, but if you're like legitimately helping somebody and that works out to your advantage, great.
Yeah, exactly. Know what you're getting yourself into. If somebody offers work for exposure,
yeah,
tell them exposure does not put food on the table.
Yeah. In fact, it takes food off the table because it's got an opportunity cost.
Yeah. And that's something that I really want to point out because it's important. Finally, the organization. Freelancing is more than just developing. It's being your own project manager. It's being the sales team, the tech support, the customer care.
The email marketing, the network admin at your house, the all that stuff
fall onto you. And one thing that you must put some money and time into is invoicing software.
And that's why I actually use Toggle for that. Is, you know, it's, I get the report, I dump it out, and there we go. Of course, most of the things I've worked with have been through recruiting companies, and they had invoicing software. Now, that was part of why they got a cut. But you got to get that figured out. Like, you don't want to be trying to chase down how many billable hours you put on something, because you just wasted billable hours doing something that you can't charge for.
Exactly.
Like, you got to cut that crap out. It's the same thing with, you know, getting enough, you know, getting decent equipment, getting all those kind of things. Like, you don't want to be burning time and money on stuff that doesn't provide value. And it's the same reason I recommend time tracking software.
We had an entire episode on time tracking.
Yeah, and how valuable that actually is. And that's why, is you want to be able to track your time and you don't want to spend any time on it.
Well, you got me into using it back when I was apprenticing with you.
Yeah.
I still use it.
Yep.
Because it's so convenient, because I have to put my time in anyways. But I get to work, I click start. I finish up, I'm getting ready to leave for the day, I click stop.
I click start when I get out of the car, and I click stop when I get in the car. And I do that as a consultant, just throwing another thing out, because companies will say, oh, you're a consultant, you're not a real employee, you can park 3/4 of a mile away. It's like, that's fine, but I'm billing for walking. I guess the other thing with the invoicing is, you're going to find that you also have to track those. Like, it's not just a thing of, oh, I need to dump a report. Like, you're going to have some discipline around that, because one thing that people will not do is pay you.
So true.
The first, or I guess it was it the second run, second or third run of freelancing that I did, that actually ended that gig, because I had a full-time contracting thing, and then I had stuff I was doing after hours. The full-time thing tapered down, and I was still waiting to get paid for the after-hours thing, and I thought I was going to be okay, and they never paid. And there were some contractual things going on there, and it was hard for me to track time down, and there's some other problems that I don't want to get into. But it was essentially like a month and a half's worth of work that I never got paid for. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have appropriate follow through on the invoicing. Like, this will hurt you very, very fast, because people can remain complete slobs and not pay you longer than you can stay solvent. So it's not just invoicing, but it's accounts payable or accounts mm-hmm. receivable. Like, actually, you have to manage both of those.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to have some modicum of ability to manage your books. That's not something you can just let slide.
And so that pretty much wraps us up for talking about freelancing. Before we close everything out, Will, what do you have for us this week for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, I brought it up earlier, and that's the concept of covert contracts. That's the idea that if I do something for you, you'll do something for me, but I'm not going to tell you what you're going to be doing for me. You think that you're getting something for free. And I think everybody's probably had a family relationship or a dating relationship or something like that that has included those, and they realize how bad this is. Here's another little twist, and this is actually software specific. When you are creating an instance of an object, the object that's creating it is effectively in a covert contract. In other words, it's saying, I'm going to manage the lifetime of this thing. I'm going to manage all the stuff it needs without really specifying that up front. This is why we get into dependency injection, inversion of control, and those kind of concepts, is because it breaks that. In other words, you don't want to be in a situation where you're creating an implicit contract for something that isn't directly specified, because then it becomes very hard to manage. This also plays out in your personal life. In fact, Beej and I went to a discussion about inversion of control and dependency injection, and I cannot remember the guy's name that taught it, but it was excellent. But one thing that struck me about this was the similarity between what happens when an object instantiates another object and a covert contract in a psychological sense, because it's kind of the same thing. It's, I'm going to do something with this thing. It's not going to be explicit, and now I have a dependency, because that's effectively what you're doing with psychological covert contracts, is you're taking a dependency on somebody else that isn't explicit. That's really bad in software too. That's why we talked about the whole, not coding, not building things for people for exposure. It's the same principle. It's, you're essentially creating a dependency chain where their failure causes your failure. You'll see this in psychology. You'll see it the same way in software development. Just want to throw that out there as kind of an interesting little tidbit that I picked up. So that's what I got.
Stand by for Titanfall.
If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at CompleteDeveloperPodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with the news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.